All right, council, are you ready now?
Yes, sir.
All right. We were a little delayed today making sure all of this equipment was working right, and so sorry about the late start, but you still have your full time. All right, the next case is 70435, Brandon Guevara-Pontifis versus the state of Nevada. This is an appeal on a criminal conviction from a jury verdict. And Ms. Butko, if you want to come up and also identify yourself for the record with the recording.
Thank you. Good morning. Carla Butko on behalf of Brandon Guevara-Pontifis. May it please the court, counsel, and my client's family is all in court to watch the proceedings this morning. Okay. This is a very intriguing appeal case because there are so many issues and so many things that didn't go according to plan on this particular trial. I'm going to start with one that is near and dear as the victim using as an interpreter. This is something that I've not seen in the appellate litigations that I've handled. I've not seen the victim be agreed to interpret the statements of the defendant.
I was very surprised when I saw that issue on appeal because I had never seen that before either, at least not in a trial.
I was surprised as well.
But I'm wondering if that's really, is that really an accurate characterization of what happened? I mean, it's not like that she was the interpreter there. Wasn't she more like a translator and she was looking at a text message or documents and saying, this is what they say?
You know, it's actually the way the state tried to portray that. But when we look at the actual questions asked by Deputy D.A. Bolenbaker, he actually tells her at one point, now, Yari, tell the truth. What does it say? And then he critiques her interpretation as well. She uses the word of, she says, I can't really translate that. I can't explain that. And she uses the word disgraceful or something similar. And it's almost a made-up word. And the D.A. interprets it as a disgrace and gives her the word. And so what we have is we don't know what was on that text. And the jury didn't either, which is why the jury came back with a question saying, can we have a legitimate English-Spanish translation? And the court responded, no, Yari interpreted, and you're to accept her interpretation.
Was there another interpreter in the courtroom?
There was, supposedly. We didn't hear from that person, and we never heard anybody say on the record whether they were happy or unhappy with Yari's cross-examination or direct examination as a hostile witness on that subject.
Wasn't there a standby interpreter, like, standing there? So if the defense counsel wanted to, they could have put the standby right in there, and they didn't.
And they said that at the onset, but they never said who it was, and they never said whether they were still in the courtroom at this stage of the proceedings. And so I assume, because they said she was going to be there, she was, or he was, but we don't know. And nobody said, are the parties happy with Yari's translation? Do we see a need to call the interpreter? It never happened.
Did the defense know what the translation was before that proceeding started, as if the DA seemed to know?
We don't know. That's not on the record either. What we hear is Ms. Puzic say, the DA say there's some snafu. We did not get our certified translations of this text messages and the DVD. We did not get them done before trial. And then the defense agrees, we'll let Yari say what they say. And my client didn't take the stand, so it was never something that he went on the stand and said, that's not what I said, this is what I said.
So assuming you're right about it, what is the prejudice that would require a new trial?
Well, the prejudice is we're hearing what the defendant's statements are. We know the jury, of all the things they're troubled with this, because they send out a jury question saying, give us this. So we know that's a problem. From there, we don't know what they really said. Now, I thought the standard on appeal is to stick with the record that you have. So I didn't go out and have them translated and have them put in here with a certified transcript, because I saw it on appeal as you're stuck with what the jury got.
Okay. All right, let's move on since there's so many issues.
Next issue is I'm going to hit with is the prosecutorial misconduct in this case. Normally, the court finds harmless error, kind of closes a blind eye and says trials get heated and life moves on. But this particular case, the prosecutorial misconduct is rampant. It's pervasive through the entire trial. The victim is basically advised, and the jury is advised, that she is a material witness bond over her head, and she will testify. And the DA, during this conversation, says, I'm the bad guy, right? I'm the bad guy. Because when she doesn't show up for the hearing and I tell her, you could be arrested, and she is arrested, well, that's my fault. I'll take that any day. That's my job. I asked you about that, talking to the jury. That's my job. Am I supposed to just say, throw up my hands? Is that what we want in Washoe County?
What if we agree with you on that, and obviously Judge Flanagan did, and Judge Flanagan sustained this objection. Jurors are told that they're to follow, you know, the law, and they were advised and instructed that arguments of attorneys are not evidence in the case. And here the judge sustained the objection. So how has that, why again do you need a new trial based on that one statement?
Well, it's not just one statement, but he sustained the objection and he did not tell the jury to disregard the commentary. So the jury, I have a hard time sometimes when they say sustained or overruled, and I've been doing this 30 years. And here's a jury, the judge says sustained, and he keeps going.
Except that they're told preliminarily with instructions to follow the law and that attorneys' questions or argument are not evidence. They're told that before trial and prior to arguments.
Correct, but then this doesn't stop. I mean, if we read just that argument, if we go back to the Huffman-Stoner-Yates case of 1985 with Mills Lane, which is probably one of the preeminent prosecutorial misconduct cases that this court's ever ruled on, it's a similar argument. It's, do you think I would prosecute someone that I didn't personally think was guilty? Is this what you want for Washoe County? You want us to not prosecute people because the victim doesn't want to cooperate with us? So it's a conscience of the community as well as error. And the jury's not told. You're not to use the conscience of the community argument, period. The other statements made, Mr. Bollenbaker says when he's in his closing argument, whether we, not just the jury, should celebrate or congratulate Mr. Guevara for not raping the women who testified at trial on his behalf. He asked, is this an accomplishment? That's something you should be proud of? As if it's an achievement? I wonder if they
were tested. They did put on an ex-girlfriend, correct?
They put on several. And they
So then why is it error for a prosecutor in rebuttal to make an argument?
Because he's arguing in
why if the defense chose to put on girlfriends and ex-girlfriends in a sexual assault trial, why is that particular statement error?
Because
prosecutorial misconduct.
He's accusing him of prior bad act of raping them and asking the jury to infer that he had improper relations with them, and were they texting during their discussions? It's just totally too
inflamed. No, they said, are we to congratulate them for not raping them? He's not accusing of rape.
Well, I don't know how to interpret that. I would interpret it as, gee, did he hurt them as well, and were they texting while he was hurting them? And it's totally made up, because these people testified that Mr. Guevara Pontifus was a gentleman, was kind, and was decent. They didn't testify that he was abusive. The other stuff that he says is he has a theme going through this. His entire theme is that Mr. Guevara Pontifus thought sex would solve everything. And that's why he had sex with Yari on that date, because he was going to solve everything by having sex with her. He says that on virtually every page of both closing arguments. He says it three times on one of the rebuttal argument pages. So his theory of the case...
Why can't a state say his theory of the case, even if it's wrong?
Because there's no evidence.
Why can't they say their theory of the case? How is that error?
There's no evidence that Mr.
With closing argument? It's just argument.
But you have to argument facts. You can't just come up with a theory and make it out of thin air. You have to have facts. There's no facts in the record that Mr. Guevara Pontifus thought his relationship with Yari would be solved by the two of them making love. That's just not here. The other thing he did was he asked the jury to judge him. He used the words, judge him. That's improper argument. Then he doesn't say, 2 seconds later, he says, judge him for his actions. Not decide the facts. You're here to decide the facts, not judge a man. We're not in church. They are not a deity. They are there to decide the facts of the case, not judge Mr. Guevara Pontifus. Totally improper argument. He also told the jury to disregard the domestic battery charge because they were there to hear only the three charges the state filed against him, when in reality, with the transition instruction, If they didn't decide.
Wasn't he just telling the jury, follow this instruction. Look at the charges that we filed. You don't even get to the lesser included unless you have a problem with the charges we filed.
But he didn't explain it that way. He actually told the jury they were not there to decide whether domestic battery occurred. And Yari testified clearly that she thought this was a domestic battery. And she thought that's what would happen to Mr. Guevara-Pontifes.
But was the jury instruction wrong in any way?
No, the jury instruction was correct. It was the green instruction.
Okay.
Then the bite wound evidence that was argued. There was no evidence to support the fact that the bite wound was the worst bite wound that the expert witness had ever seen, Ms. Bristol, had ever seen in her career. In fact, she said no bite wound, because she hadn't seen one before. Then the DA, during closing argument, argued that this was the worst bite. It would be used as a training to show a bad bite. The worst bite is an awful bite. And so he's arguing that this particular picture would be used at training classes by Ms. Bristol. There's no evidence of that because she said she hadn't seen a bite. So we don't know if it's a regular bite, a bad bite, a big bite, a sex bite, a playful bite. We know that Ms. Bristol thought it was very red.
It's real easy for all of us on appeal to look at the transcript and see that the way somebody said it wasn't exactly the way the evidence was. So did he distort the evidence? Was it intentional? What's the effect of it?
I think the effect is extremely prejudicial because the jury is hearing from Yari that they like to have rough sex. The other women also testified that rough sex was part of whatever his demeanor was or their relationships were. And Ms. Puzik pretty much argued on her closing argument that society has come to a point where sexual relations between a man and a woman have changed because of TV, because of videos, because of whatever. And so when you get to the bad bite, that's changing the defense burden here. Because the defense is saying the bite was part of fun sex, rough sex, and Yari's saying it was. And she's mad that he bit her.
How could this not be said to be, in this case, harmless evidence? Because here you have pictures of her hair ripped out of her head. You also had a 911 call in which the jurors could actually listen to the interplay of what was going on during the sexual encounter, so to speak, whether you describe it as a sexual assault or you describe it as consensual, rough play sex, as the defense, I guess, would describe it as. They heard the 911 tape. In fact, the DA said at one point, you can be a fly on the wall. You're listening to what happened during the actual act itself. So they had all of this to listen to, which we don't have in front of us. Why can't we, even if we believe that everything that was said was prosecutorial misconduct, how is that not harmless error if the jury had physical evidence to, I guess, corroborate what the DA was saying in this case?
Because not only does the DA play that tape, he stops and he looks at the jury and he says, it's so good, let's play it again. It's over the edge. It's over the edge. And very quickly, I want to talk about Joanne Lippert's...
I forgot. Do you want to save any rebuttal time?
I'm trying to save 2 minutes.
All right, go ahead.
Joanne Lippert's testimony, in my opinion, and as I read it, comments on the ultimate question of fact for the jury. That's the credibility of the witness. And they had a motion in limine where they agreed. The state says that the defense pulled their motion, but the judge actually ruled and denied the motion in limine. And then the defense attorney commented as long as the state follows the rules. And so at no time did the defense walk away from the fact that Joanne Lippert couldn't testify to the issue of credibility of Yari.
Yeah, but the judge said she would take it up if the DA crossed the line, and there was never any indication in the record the DA did cross the line, and there was no objection.
Well, I think there's clear record that there was no
objection. I think there's... Oh, go ahead.
There's a clear record that...
No, I wanted to ask, though, in that, you know, when they approached the bench in that particular scenario, because then the expert witness starts talking about the videotape and what's depicted within the videotape, how do we get around the Perez case? Because I understand that, you know, there was a bench conference and then afterwards the defense counsel did make another objection on the record, and I see that, and it looks like, you know, they had no problem, the defense, as to the dynamics of domestic violence or, you know, whatever, recanting victim. But then the expert goes into actually talking about what's depicted on the videotape.
Exactly. And she goes,
but how do you get around Perez, I guess, is what I'm asking, because we're in the Court of Appeals. How do you get around Perez?
Well, I think you get around it because Joanne Lippert wasn't qualified to comment on the evidence of Yari or Mr. Guevara-Pontifis, because she only saw one jail video, 4 phone calls out of 35 did she see. She read the police reports, we don't know what. She never met Yari, she never met Mr. Guevara-Pontifis, and she didn't even review his statement to the police. Yet
right,
she's testifying on his opinions.
All right, Ms. Buckle, you better stop now if you want any rebuttal. So at this point, you've got 1 minute rebuttal, unless Mr. McCarthy goes over.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Silver and Judge Givens. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County on behalf of the state, and I never go over my time.
All right. Good. Well, I wanted to ask.
Well, now you've challenged us, Mr. McCarthy.
But in this case, that's actually a pointed issue because the opening brief from Ms. Butko is 72 pages, and the response brief is 22 pages. So she raises 15 different claims of prosecutorial misconduct. So I mean, you can't even cover all those in 22 pages, let alone everything in this case.
I think I covered them all. Most of them didn't require much of a response. I didn't see most of the claims of misconduct do not amount to misconduct at all. Only one resulted in an objection, and in that case, there's no request for any additional relief. So what's there to review?
Well, should the judge have told the jury right at that point to disregard this because the objection was sustained?
I think that when we deal with this kind of thing, similar circumstances, we leave it to the defense to seek whatever remedy they want. They can say, I want a mistrial, and I want the jury admonished. Whatever remedy it is they want, the defendant should say so. Now, personally, I don't think that any remedy was appropriate there at all. In the defense argument, they had approached a nullification type of thing, saying you ought to decide not based on the evidence, but based on the fact that this prosecutor's a jerk. Well, it invites a response. And that's all it was. It was an invited response. It shouldn't have been labeled as misconduct. And the judge is not required to sua sponte decide what additional remedy the defense wants when the defense won't say.
So, well, wouldn't you agree, though, that it's misconduct when you tell the jury, is this what you want in Washoe County? I mean, isn't that really a call to arms? I mean, it was sustained. Is that not just maybe the prosecutor got caught up in the heat of the moment on that issue of what you're calling invited argument? But how do you not concede that statement is not misconduct?
Well, I'm more or less conceding it because that was the finding of the trial judge, and I haven't cross-appealed or in any way attacked that. My opinion is that it shouldn't have been labeled as misconduct because it was responsive. But my argument is that there's no need to do anything more than what the defense asked for. They made an objection, they got a ruling. If you want something else, if you want the jury admonished, if you want a mistrial, our courts have said, no gamesmanship here. If you raise this for the first time now, and you say, I want a whole new trial, you're avoiding the possibility of a better remedy. So the appropriate thing to do, if the defense counsel had said, Judge, I want a mistrial, this jury is irretrievably contaminated because of these comments by the prosecutor in response to what I said, and the judge could have said, no, I think that's a little over the top, and I'll admonish. But there was nothing. There was no request for it. And until we get here where there is no other remedy other than a mistrial. But certainly if they had asked for a mistrial and the judge had said no, mistrial is not warranted, that would be reversed for an abuse of discretion and the court would find no abuse of discretion. So by bypassing that proper procedure, the defense has limited the authority, or limited the options available, and kind of forced this court into considering a mistrial sua sponte, or not sua sponte, de novo. And I think that's appropriate. We shouldn't encourage that sort of gamesmanship. If you want something, ask for it.
Let me ask you this. Speaking of gamesmanship, Mr. McCarthy, and Is it the practice of Washoe County DAs to go into, you know, when you put an expert on there to explain the dynamics of domestic violence to the jury and recanting victims, like in this case, is it the practice to give your expert witness only part of the evidence and then ask them questions regarding, I mean, maybe not credibility of testimony, but credibility of the actions depicted in, say, a photograph or videotape? Hasn't this crossed the line on Perez?
No.
I mean, certainly you can ask about, you know, the dynamics of domestic violence, but right when there's that bench conference, I mean, what do you make of that? That's something, I'm going to tell you, I've been doing it 28 years down here, and it's not something that's practiced down in SVU here, or is it? See, I've not seen that before, to be honest, in the district courts here.
Well, I've never seen an expert that has ever had all possible evidence presented to them beforehand, any expert from anybody. So we have to wait until the end of the trial before we know all the evidence. In fact, more often than not, we have to...
No, I'm talking about strictly what you give that expert. In this case, they clearly gave the expert a couple, or I don't know, maybe not, maybe it wasn't 30 phone calls, but they only gave him, say, four. And here you've got a prosecutor asking them to just look at part of the evidence.
But it's difficult to respond to the question, what is the custom? I assume that the custom is to ask the expert, what do you need in order to be able to voice an opinion?
And but there was no objection.
But that's an opinion as to ultimate issue that the jury makes of whether or not she's a victim of domestic violence. You're asking a jury to make the connection between the dynamics of domestic violence and the generalities of what that expert can provide on education that's helpful to the jury, and then you actually make the connection of consistent with the victim of, in this case, in this particular case.
There was no inappropriate opinion here. And by the way, there was, after that bench conference, defense counsel revealed she does not have an objection. At page 611, she's very clear, no objection at all. She's quite satisfied with the testimony. There was no opinion on whether there was a sexual assault. There was an observation that this witness is acting consistent. But that's all there is, and that is allowable. Now, the rest...
And there was no objection that, oh, she only got part of the record, and therefore her testimony is not reliable. I mean, you can argue that, but there was no objection.
And if there had been an objection, the response would be, that's an appropriate topic for cross-examination. If you want to argue that someone's opinion is not reliable, then show that they didn't have a full basis for it. But that's not a question for this court. Especially with no objection. There's no objection beforehand, and there's no objection afterwards. That seems to be a common theme throughout this appeal, that there's very few rulings for this court to review. And so unless we're going to adopt a more paternalistic attitude of looking for error, I'd say that the court ought to simply affirm. So, I think... My reaction to the word interpreter, going back a little bit, was much the same as you, Judge Gibbons, said. There was no interpreting. What was relevant is the perception of the message by this witness. What message did you perceive? And she was able to relate that. The procedure was agreed to beforehand, and there was no objection raised beforehand or afterwards. The defense said, our remedy will be to just check it out by having our own expert there to agree or disagree, and if there's a problem, we'll get back to you. Well, there apparently wasn't. I agree that it is unusual that to have a victim translating something in the courtroom. It's been done, but I agree it's unusual. But this, the choice of terms, calling this witness an interpreter, not altogether accurate. I would say simply she explained the perception of the message that she received, and there's nothing wrong with that, and certainly nothing that would require the district court to intervene sua sponte. So, let's see, there was several claims of misconduct, and frankly, I don't think any of them really amount to misconduct. You know, there's when you take the history of the decisions of Nevada courts on the subject of prosecutorial misconduct, it's never defense misconduct for some reason. I don't know why. But actually, I do know why. But I think you can discern a general category. You know what's wrong? It's wrong to urge the jury to make a decision based on something other than the strength of the evidence. None of that happened in this case. The comment where the prosecutor's defending himself, that's maybe inappropriate. My friend Ms. Butko used the expression at the end of her argument, she says this was over the edge. That's not an appropriate standard unless we're going to define the edge. And the edge has been defined by things like expressions of personal opinion. There is an exception the hyperbole of calling a witness a liar. But that's a well-defined line.
Well, which one did you think went a little too far? Just a minute ago you said?
Well, even though I don't think it was misconduct, I don't think it was appropriate for that prosecutor to respond to the attack and say, you know, I'm the bad guy. I didn't care for it. If he had asked me beforehand, I probably would have recommended against it. But I think it's understandable because the defense argument was essentially, you should acquit not because of the evidence or the law, but because this prosecutor's a jerk. And I think it's an appropriate response.
But wasn't the prosecutor really demeaning the defense witnesses, whether they're character witnesses or not, by saying, well, we're going to congratulate them for not raping these other women? I mean, how else could that be interpreted?
As saying that they have nothing much to add. They are essentially character witnesses, and inappropriate character witnesses, too.
Right, but the DA didn't object.
No, he didn't. He was waiting
for that rebuttal argument.
Well,
why object?
I doubt it, but I suppose that's remotely possible. But anyway, they're inappropriate character witnesses, and there's nothing wrong with saying all they had to say is that this guy never raped out. Well, maybe that's a sentencing argument, you know, that he didn't rape everybody. But it's merely a comment on the probative value.
But we've seen these cases from the Supreme Court where they talk about the prosecution cannot demean the defense counsel or the defense witness. You can attack their credibility, but you can't demean them.
I don't think this was demeaning at all. This was attacking the substance of their testimony and the probative force of their testimony, saying there are no conclusions to be drawn from the mere fact that these people came in and said they had relations with him that didn't result in rape. That's
not how he said it, though.
Well, he used different languages, but the result was the same, is to say, you should draw no inferences from this evidence, because there's none available. It doesn't change the outcome. You know, on this occasion, he acted contrary to his character. Well, you know, it's not misconduct to say that's not a very persuasive argument.
Even though you have a victim recanting much of her pretrial testimony.
I don't think that changes the analysis at all. I mean, I agree that this was a difficult case to try because, you know, there's so much of was dependent upon excited utterances and prior inconsistent statements and the like, that doesn't change the parameters of the claim of misconduct. So I don't believe there was one.
What about the bite mark one?
The witness said, I can't remember the exact language, but she said something like, just the redness of it. She described it as extraordinary. Now, the prosecutor didn't use the same language. He said worst she'd ever seen, when all she said was, she didn't use the word extraordinary, but that was, I interpreted it to mean this wound was unusual, extraordinary. And because the prosecutor isn't required to mimic the exact language of the witnesses, I wouldn't find that to be misconduct at all.
But he also said, well, they'll use that in the training class, as if the witness had said that when she didn't.
Well, I think that might be an appropriate comment in this court. But there's no adverse inference.
But it rebuts the defendant's statement that this was just a routine activity during their sexual encounters.
But the part about using it is in training, I mean, that doesn't. The first part where the prosecutor says, this is an extraordinary woman, or the witnesses describe this as an extraordinary woman. He said, worst she'd ever seen. She said something else. I forget the exact language. That's not misconduct. And then the comment about using it later.
Without taking any individual one now, Ms. Butko started out with that this case was rampant with prosecutorial misconduct.
I see very little. I see very little misconduct here. And that which resulted in an objection is non-existent.
Okay, so essentially, if there had been such misconduct, there would have been objections.
You know, I recall a plea bargaining case where the court said in a footnote that if the parties who are present don't perceive a breach, then that's a good reason to believe that there wasn't really a breach. And so if the parties who are present to hear the tone and the tenor of the comment and to witness it, if they don't perceive that the prosecutor is asking the jury to decide for some improper reason, this court shouldn't make that conclusion on its own.
All right, thank you very much.
I've done it. I've run over my time.
All right.
See, we told you we could challenge you on this.
Well done.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Ms. Butko, Mr. McCarthy has delivered you 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I'm going to begin with my comment is over the edge. The rule of law is that if misconduct is persistent or repeated, then Deputy D.A. Bollenbaker accepted the risk that this court would find it to be pervasive, find that the jury was influenced by his misconduct, and that effect was incurable. And that's where I think we are. This is a case where Mr. McCarthy said the witnesses were put up, the girlfriends as character witnesses. They were put up from the standpoint that rough sex was common, not from a character witness standpoint. So they were properly there to testify. Mr. Bollenbaker told the jury not to consider the other 28 to 33 jail calls that actually occurred between preliminary hearing and trial between the defendant and Yari. And this witness gave four different versions of what happened. One to one police officer, one to another police officer, a completely different version at preliminary hearing, and yet another version at trial. The jury was shown the fact that this client was in custody because an IWEB visit came in, and the judge said, if that comes in, I will give a cautionary instruction. There was no cautionary instruction given concerning the fact that he was in custody.
How do you know that the jury would know that IWEB meant something? Mr. McCarthy said he had never heard of it before. I've never heard of it before. I bet Chief Judge Silver.
I've never heard of it before.
I mean, why would the jury
know
that?
I never heard of that. It was something that I assumed was up north.
Well, I guess for us, it's the norm. And so IWEB visits is how you visit anybody that's at the Washoe County Jail if you're family members.
So the jury would know the person was in jail from the reference to IWEB?
I would think so. If there's 12 jurors there, I hope all their lives are perfect and none of their friends or family have ended up in jail. But if they have visited, they IWEBed it.
All right.
Then, as far as my argument, there's insufficient evidence because this witness testified with a material witness bond, an attorney standing in court with her father watching what she says. Her father notably doesn't like my client. She was bullied by the DA with 53 questions saying, didn't you tell Officer so-and-so this, and never given her transcripts. With that, I would submit.
Thank you, Ms. Butko.
Thank
and
you.
Again, and again, Mr. McCarthy, good job by all. This is a difficult case. It was unusual case. Everybody agrees with that, and there are a lot of issues raised here on the appeal. So the court will take it under submission and will be issuing a written order in the not too distant future.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
We'll be in.